Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have another conversation with Chris Hedges, who joined us just a couple of months back. We've been waiting for his new book to come out. We read one chapter on the way, and it arrived. And his latest book he did with Joe Sacco is called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. And as way of reintroduction, Chris is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute. Chris Hedges won the Pulitzer in 2002 with the New York Times team on global terrorism. You can read his column at Truth Dig. Just has a new one this week. And he writes for many magazines. His other books were Death of a Liberal Class, Empire of Illusion, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Joe Sacco, who you partnered with in this book, who's not with us today, is an amazing cartoonist and was with us last to talk about his book, Palestine Footnotes on Gaza, when that book came out. And this is a book they put together. And Chris Hedges, welcome.
Good to have you with us.
The last time I saw you, you were in the waiting room at WEAA, busily trying to finish some chapters or something to get off to the publisher.
That's right. I edit the last edit I do is by hand. I think that's what I was doing.
So, Chris, that's how this book. This is it's interesting. You teamed up with Joe Sacco for this book, and chose to visit some of the most dislocated communities in America, as well as kind of when as you walk politically and philosophically through America. But talk about how this book started and why you chose to do what you did with this book.
Well, we'd worked together before. We'd first met in Bosnia in 1995 when he was doing his book Garajda, and I was the Balkan bureau chief for the New York Times. And I'm not particularly familiar with graphic novels, but I watched him work and realized he was an absolutely brilliant journalist, and then started reading his work. And we did a long piece for Harper's Magazine out of Gaza, and then we did a piece for Nation. And I really wanted to do a book with him because he can give, especially visually, a kind of punch that is very difficult to achieve in prose. And so because I was really writing about invisible communities, this gigantic underclass that has now enveloped the country and which is very rarely seen, I knew that bringing him into this project, and there are 50 pages of illustrations in the book, as well as comic panels where he sort of tells the stories of people's lives, that he could in essence make visible in a more powerful form what I was trying to do, which was the ultimate objective of the book, to sort of bring these people alive.
And you visited Pine Ridge, went to West Virginia, went to Camden, went to the Immokalee workers in Florida, and ended up with Occupy.
Yeah. Well, when we started the book 2 years ago, the title was Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. The belief being that unfettered, unregulated capitalism without any impediments – there are no impediments now to corporate power – knows no limits. It will push and push and push until there's a backlash. But the backlash when we started was conjecture. And then on September 17th, there was the occupation of Zuccotti. And we realized – I mean neither of us had anticipated it.
Who did?
Yeah. Right. That's – exactly where the book had to end up, because that was the logical conclusion to a political system where the citizen has been rendered impotent.
So, there's a lot in this book. There are so many ideas that came out of this book that I think that that you explore in some depth, because you end up interviewing all these people from the reservation, from Rosebud, from Appalachia, from Camden, the Immokalee workers, Luis Benitez and others. But you also – it's not just about the interviews. This is about really your analysis of where you think society has come to. And this relationship you see I think is interesting. But let's explore a couple of them as you talked about them. In the very beginning, you talk about the twisted notion of regeneration through violence that you see as at the core of Western capitalism. So talk a bit about that concept.
Well, that's why we began with Pine Ridge, a Lakota Indian reservation where the average life expectancy for a male is 48, the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. Because America, unlike European nation states, colonized its own land in essence. It didn't go to Africa or India.
Mm-hmm.
It exterminated, largely exterminated the Native American population, turned the land, of course, eradicated, virtually eradicated the buffalo herds, turned the land over to the railroad corporations, and shunted the indigenous peoples into absolutely the worst land in the West, including the Sioux Reservation at Pine Ridge. And it wasn't just the destruction of a community. It wasn't just the seizure of land. It was about destroying another configuration of community, of existence, that was antithetical to capitalism. Indigenous or native tribes were communal. Those who hoarded goods, wealth, were considered pariahs within the community. It had a deep sense of the sacred within the natural world. And all of this was destroyed by gold speculators and timber merchants and everyone else who came out west and looked at the land simply as a commodity by which they could ensure their own personal wealth. And I think that starting with Pine Ridge was important because it was a window into the whole demented project where we exploited, destroyed, exhausted these outer sacrifice zones. And now that they have largely been destroyed, that corporate leviathan is eating or cannibalizing what's left in the same kind of myopic devotion to profit at the expense of human life and, of course, at the expense of their ecosystem itself. And it all began there with, you know, and I use that term, which is from Richard Slotkin's great trilogy on the decimation of Native American cultures, starting with the Pequots and going all the way up through to the early 19th century, that idea that you can regenerate a society through violence. And that was, of course, very much a part of the ethic that permitted the physical destruction and slaughter of Native American communities with this misguided belief that out of that slaughter would come progress.
One of the things I was thinking about as looking at this whole book was that how much you think your analysis says that the roots of capitalism, especially Western capitalism, that created – they came out of the slave trade and the annihilation of indigenous people and built its power from there out. That how much of the way those seeds were sown to develop the world we have today are also the seeds of its own destruction. So I'm saying? I mean, it felt – there's a connection here, and I can see you looping through it as you write.
Well, and you know, that's Karl Marx, actually.
Yeah.
Marx said that unfettered, unregulated capitalism was a revolutionary force that had built within it a mechanism for its own self-annihilation. And that's precisely right. And that's where we are. That's what's happening.
That's where you think we are at this moment in history.
Yes.
So, I mean, because you make those connections. You make the connection – especially towards the end of the book, you make the connection between what happened in the beginning with the annihilation of indigenous people in America and their way of existence. And you write – when you look at Zuccotti Park and the occupiers, you talk about them as kind of reaching back to that place in terms of how they want to manage themselves. And there's some kind of full circle you see coming both in terms of capitalism and the struggle around it.
Well, one of the great benefits of the Occupy movement is that they certainly understood corporate power and corporate capitalism and how – what a destructive force it has been and remains. And of course, we have very little time left.
What do you mean? Talk about – what do you mean by that? We have very
little time left. Because of the climate crisis. I mean the planet – and there's quite a chilling article in Nature this month where they interview the top 16 climate scientists who – talk about catastrophic ecological collapse, making life for most of the human species unsustainable. That's where – that's the awful logic of profit. That's the awful logic of allowing ExxonMobil or BP or anyone else to determine your relationship with the natural world. Anybody who's sat down and seriously read climate science reports, should probably be in a state of panic. And yet we're pretending it doesn't exist. Or at best we're pretending we can adapt. Because the forces that control our relationship to the ecosystem are corporations whose only goal is the maximization of profit, short-term profit, even if they create an environmental holocaust.
I mean, what we're seeing right now in Rio is really about adapting. I mean, that's what's being pushed.
And it's also, the most enlightened segments of the American society are about adapting. It's not about facing the fact. I mean, you have people like Hansen and Bill McKibben and others, of course, who are ringing the alarm bells, but within the wider culture. And they're both equally forms of self-delusion. If we do not radically alter our relationship with the ecosystem and dramatically curtail our dependence on fossil fuels, we're finished.
One of the things that also strikes me, this is maybe the last time we spoke, and this book in particular, which I really did enjoy a great deal, just the stories, individual stories and how you wound the analysis through the stories, I think is very important to wrestle with. Whether you agree with everything you wrote or not, it's an important book to wrestle with. Is that part of this is your journey. I mean, a lot of what you write is also your journey. I mean, it's your journey as the man who went to a divinity school and sees this when you write about the notion of kind of evil and in the upper classes and what you see tied to this pain you feel when that one part of your book when you talk about the faces that haunt you, the kids that you remember from the war zones and places you've been and looking at your own children's faces and you seem to be able to tie these things together to say this is who we are and where we are.
Well, in that particular example, it is the ties are actually quite apparent because having worked in Africa, I understand what happens when commodity speculators and one of the largest commodity price index speculators in the world is out of Goldman Sachs will buy up futures of rice, beans, wheat, which has increased in price by 100% over the last year. I know what that means for the world's poor. I've covered the famines in the Sudan, for instance. And with Cornel West in Zuccotti Park, held a people's hearing of Goldman Sachs where we brought in people who had lost their homes, public school teachers who had lost their jobs, and then several hundred of us marched down to Goldman Sachs where I was arrested with other demonstrators when we sat down in front of the building and didn't move. And for me, it was really a way to come to the doors of a corporation which I knew was quite literally responsible for the deaths of tens, hundreds of thousands of people. And in famines, those who die are usually, of course, the weakest and most vulnerable, which are the children and the elderly. And I've seen them die. I write there that I have tubercular scars in my lungs from being in these feeding stations where finally what kills many of these people is tuberculosis, which just sweeps through these vast encampments and because people are so debilitated, just snuffs their lives out. There's no ability within their bodies to resist. I, of course, was strong and could resist.
As you wrote, right.
And so for me to be outside the doors of Goldman Sachs after having spent so many years of my life in the developing world where I know what commodity speculators do was, deeply moving. And I think those ties for me are not theoretical because of where I've been and what I've done. They're overpowering because I carry those images and the faces of those children with me, frankly, wherever I go. I mean, almost every day I look at my own children and I can't forget all of those small lives that were snuffed out and never given a chance.
And so here you journey through these four places, all very different but all very similar in some ways, in terms of what has happened with the dislocation in the inner city in Camden, mostly Latino and African Americans who are being crushed in a place like Camden, which we should talk about because Camden, I mean, almost most post-industrial cities are disaster zones. But I think you chose these places for a reason. You chose these places because Camden was not just a disaster zone. It is the logical consequence of where everything is headed, you think, because it's probably one of the most disastrous urban areas in the whole country.
Yeah, I mean any urban area, Baltimore, Philly, there are parts of it that survive. And it's interesting that in both Philly and Baltimore, it's essentially medical and academic.
Right.
But then there are sections, whole sections of the city like North Philly that have just fallen off the end of the truck. In Camden, there's nothing. It's completely dead. They don't make anything. They don't produce anything.
And did once.
They were a huge industrial center. I mean that's why tracing the trajectory of what happened is so powerful. I mean the port in Camden or the shipyards used to employ 36,000 people alone. It's all gone. All of it's gone. And you have whole sections, whole city blocks abandoned with trees growing out of the roofs and gas stations that are abandoned. And of course they're literally cannibalizing the city because once these buildings are abandoned, even if for a very short period of time, you have armies of people who make their living ripping out the copper piping and the screen doors and taking it down to this huge, huge scrap yard on the waterfront, and you have ships from China and Turkey coming where they load all this crushed metal onto their cargoes and take it abroad to smelt it and use it. So you're actually physically when you're in a city like Camden, you're watching it physically be disemboweled, physically dismantled, physically destroyed. And yes, we went to the worst pockets because we wanted the most dramatic examples. But what's happened in Camden is, as you point out, happening everywhere. And these were the first sacrifice zones, the first places to go. But as we reconfigure American society into a neo-feudalistic society with these pockets of obscenely rich individuals, and I live in Princeton, New Jersey, where that's what it's become, and then the rest of the country is hanging on by their fingertips at a subsistence level. And I lived in the developing world for many years. I mean I lived, for instance, in Miraflores in Lima, Peru. And if you didn't step outside the boundaries of Miraflores, you would think you're in Miami.
Right.
And yet the rest of Lima, especially the Pueblos Jóvenes, people were struggling in appalling poverty. And that's what unfettered corporate capitalism is doing. And the reason we went to these places is to say essentially to the reader, you better take a look. Because these people were first and you're next.
That it reminded me over and over again of the famous poem that was written about who they came for first in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. Was it Bonhoeffer? Was it who wrote that? I'm blocking for a second, but
it was Niemöller.
Niemöller, right? And you see society that way. I mean, that people don't pay attention. That first they come for the communists,
right.
Then they come for the trade unions,
right.
Then they come for the Jews,
right.
And then they come for me and there's no one left to say anything.
Right. Well, they've I spent a lot of time in my book, Death of the Liberal Class, talking about how we've been disempowered and essentially movements were systematically destroyed, quite consciously destroyed in the name of anti-communism. It's how Hoover tried to take down the civil rights movement. And it's the movements that have always been the correctives to American democracy. I mean the whole struggle of the miners in Southern West Virginia was a struggle to form unions and, of course, an uprising on Blair Mountain.
Right, which you write about.
Yeah, they actually got arms. And to this day, we don't really know where these boxes of new Winchesters came. But it's pretty certain that there's no miner that could have afforded on the salary they were making. And the story is, of course, that it was United Mine Workers who sent these weapons to them. And they rose up after just awful, awful forms of repression on the part of the coal companies, including hiring gangsters and, in essence, death squads. They call them gun thugs to murder union leaders and union supporters. So, you know, that whole sort of struggle, when you go back and you're in a place like West Virginia and you see the price that people paid in order to be treated fairly as workers, to have medical benefits, and of course spend long enough in a mine and you're guaranteed to have black lung.
Right.
And then the sort of culmination being the New Deal and then everything getting dismantled. You know, all of that New Deal protection legislation slowly being taken away from us. And now we just have – we have no protection left. We have no – the Democratic Party is bought and sold, of course, as all those people who invested so much hope in Barack Obama understand. And that's why I end with the Occupy movement, because I think that unless we build a mass movement, there's absolutely no way we're going to stop this or counter this sort of corporate coup d'etat.
You mentioned several things I want to probe. I'm trying to get to four or five things in this book that I'd like to probe. One of them is what you just mentioned, because part of what you write is and you've written some articles as well recently, the one you just said about the Berrigans, that you have very little hope and faith in electoral politics or that world in terms of creating change. You mentioned Cornel West, who just came out the other day and said we have to vote for Barack Obama. And you look at history and, you know, you look at the period before the Civil War and through Reconstruction, the role the radical Republicans played or progressives between – from both Roosevelts and spanning that, the battle for the right to vote that many of us fought for in the Civil Rights Movement in the South when we were young. I mean, that, a lot of that was about fighting for electoral power. But, and so in your perspective of what we have that has to be built in America to confront this unfettered capitalism, does that have no role whatsoever?
It has no role because what we want as voters is irrelevant in Washington. Corporate lobbyists write the legislation. Corporate lobbyists largely determine who gets elected and reelected. And I think that those kind of the last gasp of American democracy was Citizens United. So I deeply admire Cornell and we're friends, but I would disagree with him. I'm not going to vote for Barack Obama.
Are you going to vote?
I will vote if there's a third party alternative in New Jersey. Yes, I'll vote for either Rocky Anderson or the Green Party, or I'll go in and write none of the above. But I'm not going to vote. Of course, I just sued the guy in federal court, so I have a little pride, and won, interestingly enough.
Well, you did win that suit.
I did. I won over the National Defense Authorization
right.
Act, which permits the government, or at least until Judge Catherine Forrest issued a temporary injunction, did permit the government to use the military to seize American citizens who were branded by the government as terrorists and hold them without access to due process in indefinite detention until, in the language of this section of the bill, the end of hostilities. I mean, just an absolute and stark and egregious revoking of our basic constitutional rights to due process and a fair hearing in a court of law. I don't think that by supporting the Democratic Party, things are getting better. I think that we can go back all the way to the Clinton administration and if you look at the trajectory for the poor, for the working class, even for the middle class, it is on a precipitous decline. And we have to very rapidly find another mechanism by which we fight back. And that's that great line from Emma Goldman, if voting was that effective, it would be illegal.
Right. You have that in the book, right?
Look, movements are key. I mean the most powerful political figure in this country until he was assassinated in April of 1968 was Martin Luther King, because when he went to Memphis, 50,000 people went with him. None of the great movements, the Liberty Party, the suffragists, the labor movement, none of them ever achieved formal political power. But they opened up the space. I mean, of course, labor made the middle class possible. And so I think we have to go back and recognize that it's not our job to take power for those of us who care about justice. It's our job to build movements that make those in power afraid of us, which is why Ralph Nader correctly says that the last liberal president we ever had was Richard Nixon. Not, of course, because he was a liberal or in any way empathized with the underclass, but because he was still scared of movements. And there's that beautiful scene, I think it's from Kissinger's memoirs, where I think it's 1971 and there's a huge anti-war demonstration and Nixon's taken buses to surround the White House to protect it. And he's standing at the window wringing his hands saying, "Henry, Henry, they're going to break through and get us." And that's exactly where we want people in power to be.
So ultimately, and I'll come right back to the book here, but ultimately for you, when you think about this, is this about movements to control unfettered capitalism or do away with it?
Well, there are different forms of capitalism. There's the penny capitalism in the farm town where I grew up in upstate New York. Farmers brought their produce in and sells it. There's regional capitalism, the small business owner, the hardware store owner who sits on the school board, pays taxes, lives in the community, etc. And then there's corporate capitalism, which is very different. Corporate capitalism is supranational. It has no loyalty to the nation state. And that's what's happened. After NAFTA, we literally watched in places like Ohio as corporations packed up factories and moved them over the border to Mexico. And of course, now they're leaving Mexico to go to places like Bangladesh where they pay workers 22 cents an hour. They don't pay taxes. They move all their money offshore. General Electric paid no income tax. Bank of America paid no income tax. And these corporations, if you use the language of traditional patriotism, are traitors. They will destroy this country. They are destroying this country. They've already gone very far in destroying this country. And the political system, they have essentially turned elected officials into corporate employees. Obamacare is a classic example written by corporate lobbyists. I mean, the whole debate over Obamacare is an absurdity because the plan was hatched by the Heritage Foundation. It was put into practice by Mitt Romney in 2006 when he was governor of Massachusetts, and then it was adopted by Obama. And it, you know, with the caveat that when the pharmaceutical and insurance lobbyists wrote the 2,000-page bill, they included $447 billion in subsidies to themselves. It's the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for these industries. And then the first thing Obama does after it's passed is he starts handing out exemptions because these corporations don't want to insure chronically ill children. I mean, it's sick. And there's nothing we can do. I mean, the across the political spectrum, there's no support for the bailouts of Wall Street. But it passes anyway. The FISA Amendment Act, which retroactively makes legal what under our Constitution has traditionally been illegal, the warrantless wiretapping, monitoring and eavesdroppings of tens of millions of Americans. It passes because Verizon and AT&T and the big telecommunications companies want it passed because they've already turned the information over and they were worried about lawsuits because it used to be under our Constitution you couldn't turn over private information like that to the government. You can just go down the list. It's really – you know, turn off the TV and ignore the smoke screen and stop listening to these public relations firms that pump this stuff out. They spend a lot of time figuring out what it is you want to hear and they tell you. But, you know, the real core of power is quite cynical, including under this administration, an assault against civil liberties, which has been actually worse than Bush. The use of the Espionage Act 6 times – to shut down whistleblowers, some of whom spoke to the press, including the New York Times, to expose war crimes that had been committed. You know, as I mentioned, the NDAA or Section 1021 of the NDAA, the FISA Amendment Act, the refusal to restore habeas corpus, the very radical interpretation of the Authorization to Use Military Force Act, which Obama feels gives him the right to serve as judge, jury, and executioner and assassinate American citizens. I'm speaking, of course, of the Yemeni cleric, Elaki, and then, of course, his 16-year-old son 2 weeks later, who never did anything except try to find out what happened to his father, as far as I can tell. So you know, we better snap out of it and we better start responding and we better push back because if we don't, we are going to, in essence, become a country where dissent is criminalized and where the security and surveillance state becomes so intrusive that it essentially makes any kind of popular resistance impossible.
We're talking with Chris Hedges. Our latest conversation with him, his latest book with Joe Sacco, is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines, where you can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. I'm talking with Chris Hedges. Our latest conversation with him, his latest book with Joe Sacco, is Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. One of the things that there are some things you wrote in here that I just want to kind of explore. These quotes that really got to me. One that really hit me that I have been – it's not at the heart of your book, but it just said something to me. And it was this quote from 1984. And let me read the quote. Spoken by in the Ministry of Truth by the party leader O'Brien in the book. You made me start reading 1984 again after this quote. I started reading it again because of this quote. Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. That just has been ringing in my head since I read it in the book.
Well, that's right, because the history that we're fed is a version of history that celebrates the virtues and beneficence of the elite and ignores those fierce struggles on the part of the underclass against the elite to create a more just and equitable society. If you go down to southern West Virginia and you walk in any school, those coal companies have essentially written those textbooks. If you read about the Emancipation Proclamation, it becomes an act on the part of an enlightened white president to free the slaves. The reality of Reconstruction, and there was just a book published that talked about, of course, they estimated over 1 million African Americans dying.
Well, the latest
disease,
book. Yeah,
the
right,
latest, latest
right,
book. But, right. But, you know, anybody who understands the convict leasing program knows that in many ways after the end of the Civil War, life for African Americans was worse in terms of life expectancy because since they weren't property and since they were being arrested on false and bogus charges for vagrancy usually every time they need – and then they'd be sent out in these convict leasing chain gangs to work in the turpentine camps in northern Florida and harvest crops. And they were so poorly treated. Very few of them actually ever finished their sentence because they just – once they died, they went and got another one. The whole reign of terror in Jim Crow with lynching. And that failure to understand your own history, where you got to where you are and why, what were the forces that were most important in reforming the society, and then, you know, coupled with a culture, of course, corporate dominated, that is about trivia and gossip and entertainment, and news is entertainment. It creates a very useful historical amnesia, and that is the quote that you read. Orwell's quote is, of course, extremely prescient because
yes.
once you don't know where you came from or how you got here, then you can easily be manipulated into serving systems of power which are not at all beneficial to either you or your community.
One of the things about how we kind of repress and keep people down that I think is really important, there is a piece in your book where you talk about, I think this is out of the Camden, or Camden section, whatever section it was in, that has to do with a book that was written about how the oppressed are put in positions to destroy one another rather than stand up and fight for their rights. And we do this very effectively in our country, everywhere, whether it's the Indian Reservation, right, or whether it's inner cities or whether it's in Appalachia. And you tell stories about that all through.
Right.
That bring that up.
Right. And that was a kind of persistent theme, that the anger and frustration that people felt they took out largely on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes through this corporate mantra that we're responsible for our own position, that reality is never an impediment to what we desire, that if we dig deep enough within ourselves and we grasp that we're exceptional and we study hard in school and, you know, we can be anything we want to be. And, of course, it's a lie. I think that coupled with television, where you're poor and every night your living room is bombarded with these images of these things that you don't have and can never have, and are told that the reason you don't have them is because you are deficient and inadequate. I mean, I think television's a very, very pernicious and dark force for the underclass. And an effective way of channeling that rage and energy back in on itself. And that's why when you go to Pine Ridge, you have an 80% estimated 80% alcoholism rate. It's why you go into the old coal camps in southern West Virginia and everybody's taking Oxycontin, which they call hillbilly heroin. And it's like interviewing zombies. I mean, the ones that have not been able to get out, their eyes are glassy and they speak very slowly and they move slowly because they're just pumped up on these opiates. And that was something we found, that when you descend to that level, either you seek synthetic means by which to blunt the pain, which usually results in early death, or you go to religion. And it's not the religion of the oppressed. It's not – and I spent a little time in Camden talking about that.
You did.
It's a different it's a religion where you are you surrender in a sense to this acceptance that you are powerless, and or if you're in Pine Ridge, it was Native, you know, sweat lodges and the Sundance. We went to a Sundance which was deeply moving. I mean, all these guys with their prison tattoos trying to pull their lives back together, and so. Yeah, those seems to be the two ways that you have of coping, and that was true, you know, in every single place that we went.
But isn't there a power in? One of the things I kept thinking about is reading with parts of this, and I've experienced as well those things on the res and the ceremonies and the black church. There's a source of power though in those things. There's a source of power to stand up. There's a source of power that says there's another. This is our way. And whether inside of many of the Native American churches around the res or whether it's the black churches, the political power came out of those things.
Yeah. Yes. But, you know, at the same time, and we do, when you speak to these people, their understanding of the forces arrayed against them are very realistic. They don't have any illusions about how powerful these institutions are and how in many ways impossible it is to fight against them. I mean, when you go to southern West Virginia, the coal companies own everything, including the politicians, the press, and
the bloody Supreme Court. I mean, the state,
everything.
Right,
and there's nothing – and they all know it, and yet they resist anyway. And that is that's different from resisting it with the belief that somehow you know, it's inevitable that you're going to win. And when I talk about the religion of the oppressed, it's only when they sink to that powerlessness that they can sort of grapple with that paradox of being powerless. And I think seeing those sacred forces as not only a validation but an embrace of powerlessness, if that makes any sense. I mean, Havel writes about this in The Power of the Powerless, that you learn to live your life in truth. And even if all of the empirical forces around you contrive to define your existence and what you struggle for as a failure, you find that capacity to live in truth validates you as a human being. And I think that that is at the core of the religious experience of the oppressed, which is different from the religious experience for those who are integrated into the system and appeal to the system and in many ways feel part of the system.
There's a great quote in here, many great quotes in here, but there's a great quote in here from Blankenship, who ran Massey Coal, where the miners were murdered in I would say murdered,
right.
when for the safety conditions that were not met and people died in those mines. And he's left Massey Coal, retired, which others quote from him, where he writes, he says, "It's like a jungle, where a jungle is survival of the fittest. Unions, communities, people, everybody's going to have to learn to accept in the United States you have a capitalist society, and the capitalism from a business standpoint is survival of the most productive."
Right, at the expense of everyone else,
right,
including the Appalachian Mountains themselves.
Destroying the mountains and the people in them.
Right.
And that quote, though, coming was like saying, yes, that's who we are.
Right.
That's what we have.
Right.
Deal with it.
Right. And that is really the mantra of our corporate overlords, who have created a two-tiered system where the laws that affect you and me do not affect them at all. They write their own laws. They write their own regulations. And I think it's important to remember that, you know, we have not only created an oligarchic class, but we have created a class that essentially, because of their economic and political power, have freed themselves from any kind of legal constraints, that they have become – it's become capable in essence to legalize criminality, legalize fraud, legalize theft, legalize – dishonesty, legalize abuse. The laws that apply to them are not like the laws that apply to us, and we therefore have been utterly disempowered. I think it's Nader makes this point, and I think it's true that, you know, those of us who stand in opposition at the core are calling for a restoration of the rule of law, which on the political spectrum makes us conservatives and makes them radicals.
One of the things that struck – the little teeny thing struck me here was you wrote about Blair Mountain in West Virginia, where the battle took place. The miners fought. And it was a very sacred place to them that they want to blow up and destroy to mine –
the coal companies, yeah.
Right, the coal companies. And you also talk about the Black Hills on the Lakota and what the Black Hills meant. And I kept thinking of this relationship between Blair Mountain and the Black Hills. And kind of taking these spiritual high points of people's lives and just
– physically eradicating them.
Right.
Well, and that's not unconscious. I mean, again, it gets back to the quote you read of Orwell. It's about erasing the past, eradicating the past, points of reference, where it is we came from, what it is we fought for, who it is we are. That is really what corporate systems of information seek to – obliterate from human consciousness.
I mean, you write a lot in this book and other places about the and you kind of are very taken in some ways with the Occupy movement and seeing where it's going. We watch what's happening in Egypt right now and across the globe. But I and you look at American history, you look at world history, whether and you write about this as well. You look at the Paris Commune, you look at Haymarket, you look at things that have happened in the past where people have risen up and fought for 75 days, 100 days, 120 days, whatever it is, in resistance and moved society forward and often got annihilated in the process. And I'm wondering how you see, why you see and how you see that this horizontal process, this process of kind of a lack of demand, lack of formal leadership, is in any way capable of sustaining itself, has it been anywhere in history, sustaining itself and to confront this kind of massive machinery, this military machinery, this machinery of technological spy agencies, of everything that's at their disposal, how these kind of horizontal movements you think can actually confront that?
Well, I've seen them confront it. I covered all the demonstrations
Eastern Europe
brought down the Stasi state in East Germany. At the time, the most heavily policed state probably in the world. I think for every 63 East Germans, there was an informant.
That's what you wrote, right.
So I've seen it. What happens is when the internal systems of power become so corrupt that in essence, those who maintain those systems lose the will to defend them and fight for them. So that when you get 70,000 demonstrators in September of 1989 in Leipzig, and the communist leader Erich Honecker sends down an elite paratroop division to shoot them, they won't do it. Honecker, after that paratroop division would not fire on the crowd, lasted less than a week in office. And I think that the corruption within the corporate state is that severe. But of course it means pulling numbers, big numbers, the kinds of numbers I saw in Eastern Europe. 500,000 people in Wenceslas Square. I covered the Velvet Revolution. 500,000 people in Alexanderplatz. And the refusal on the part of the foot soldiers, those who are tasked with carrying out forms of coercion at the sort of local level, refusing to use that coercion to – and then it's over. Now, can we get there? I don't know. You know, we may not. Movements fail. But I think it's the only possibility we have left. And it's therefore essential for those of us who care about any kind of a future, especially for those of us who have children,
right,
to try. There will be a backlash. I mean, the corporate state knows only one word, and that's more.
Right.
We just watched hundreds of thousands of people in this country lose their long-term unemployment benefits.
Right.
I mean, this is just insane. It's like Versailles. It's like the Forbidden City. The elites are now so out of touch with what the ordinary American is undergoing that they have no sense of proportionality. What will that backlash look like? It could be a right-wing backlash. It could be violence. We are a very violent culture. It could be Occupy. It could be something that looks like Occupy and isn't called Occupy. But the one thing I can say, having covered many, many movements and revolutions, is that it's not over. Something's going to happen. But I also know from having covered movements and revolutions that none of us, even those who are most intimately involved in Occupy or other systems of resistance, can predict when or what it will look like.
As that quote from Lenin has in the beginning of the last chapter of your book.
Yeah.
I think that the quote is really is a very interesting quote because it's we were arguing about this very similar thing the other night before I finished your book. And the quote is, "It's impossible to predict the time and progress of revolution. It is governed by its own more or less mysterious laws. But when it comes, it moves irresistibly."
And I can tell you, having covered the revolutions in Eastern Europe, the street demonstrations that brought down Slobodan Milosevic, the first and the second Palestinian uprisings or intifadas, that's exactly right.
So I wonder, one of the things about America, though, and we didn't get a chance to get to the incredible personalities in this book, whether it's Bill Means or Lucas Benitez, who we've met many times from the Immokalee Workers, and all the other people you've talked about in this book, the people come to life in this book who resist. Larry Gibson in the mountains,
yeah.
and Mary Gonneau, who's an amazing woman who just resists the mountaintop removal and is trying to save her culture in Appalachia. And that's an important part of this book because it's about the human beings who are standing up and not just letting it happen, refusing to just let it wash over them or their people. I wonder, though, you write about in the book numerous times, but as white privilege as a constant throughout American history and the underbelly of capitalism built this Western world. How much of that contradiction foils what happens or fuels what happens to us, because it's often the thing that has divided America the deepest?
Well, and it's quite effectively disempowered us, and I write about this in the book.
That you do.
We turned our back on Native Americans. We turned our back on African Americans. The civil rights movement was a legal victory, but it was not an economic one.
Right.
And both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King understood that as long as, in essence, economic racism, these internal colonies, both Malcolm and King called them, existed, you would never have racial equality. So for the bottom third, one could argue, although, you know, statistically as the middle class sinks, it's disproportionately African Americans who fall back into poverty out of the middle class. But let's say roughly for the upper third of African Americans, they were integrated economically into the structure. But for the bottom two thirds of African Americans, life is worse than when King marched in Selma. And we – and I say we. I'm talking about liberal white society ignored them. We ignored what was happening to them. We ignored what was happening to the underclass. We did not protect the workers in the produce fields. And they came for them first, and it's the old Niemöller quote, and now they're coming for us. And you know, in biblical terms, we forgot our neighbor and the consequences of that for both our neighbor – and for us will be devastating. We are not going to be spared the fate of those we ignored.
And I think that I like the progression of the book, and I think the stories of the Immokalee workers and the immigrants and Camden and Latinos and African Americans in Camden, what they fought for in Blair Mountain and the Appalachians, whites who fought to save their mountains, and the people who are rising up again in Indian land. I mean, this is happening, and I think it's important to kind of not just show the, as you've been doing, not just show as you've been trying to show the oppression and depression, but also as you're showing the power to fight, the power to stand up.
Everywhere we went, there were these heroic figures that stood up, and what was so heroic about them is that they had no illusions, in many ways even about the hopelessness of it. And yet they fought back anyway. And that's that great quote from Hannah Arendt that those who embrace the moral life are not those who say I shouldn't or I oughtn't, but those who say I can't. And that's what's so magnificent, to walk into these pockets of utter despair and yet find these people who just rise up. Lolly Davis, this African-American woman in Camden.
In Camden, right.
Just remarkable. And I said, Lolly, how do you do it? I mean, her husband was shot, her fiance was shot and killed in a bar fight. Her little 7-year-old daughter died of an asthma attack because they couldn't afford the medicine. You know, she not only raised her own children, but by the time she was done, she's in her late 60s, had 16 or 19 kids, had been cycled through her house. I mean, just so much despair, so much. And I said, how do you sustain yourself? And she said, I never ask why. And I thought there was such a profound wisdom in that, because if you ask why, you're going to get crushed. There is the resistance itself or virtue itself has to provide its own reward, because the exterior or the outer world is not going to reward you for virtue.
So neither pessimist nor optimist, but a man who sees the possible. That's what we have to do to stand up to it.
Right.
We've been talking to Chris Hedges. He and Joe Sacco have written this incredible book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. All the connections will be on our website. It's a book that, you got a book club? Use the book. Wrestle with it. Think about it. And think about what we have to do to take this place of ours back and control it for our future and our children. Chris Hedges, once again, thanks so much, my friend. Good to
thanks,
have you.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.